Blog Talk Radio.
Just a step, cries the sad man. Take a look down at the madman. Theater king's on. Silver wings fly beyond reason. From the flight of the seagull come the spread claws of the eagle. Only fear breaks the silence as we all kneel, pray for guidance.
Freaky Darlings, and welcome to Late Night Poets After Midnight Show, where you get to take a walk on the wild side. If you're into the likes of Ginsberg, Bukowski, Phil, and Getty, Kerouac, and Morrison, then you are on the right night. But please check out our other After Midnight shows. Join Neutron tomorrow as the After Midnight Bomber, and then delve into a world of strange magic with Incoherent Dust and Victoria Frost. Fridays are split between crawling into the darkness with Pam and Break On Through. And Saturday, let Aficiana and Babbler teach you how to be part sinner, part saint. And then Monday morning, join Victoria Frost with the Hearts of LNP or Black Blaze Diaries. These shows are designed to shoot in color outside the lines with rich, raw emotions tinged with colloquial language, thereby pushing the envelope to expression and opening up new avenues of thought through pen and voice. So, pull up a chair, relax, and open your minds. I'm Rex, and my co-host, Ann Ray, and I can't wait to get into and be your words. Hey, Pam.
Hey, Rex. How's it going?
All right, babe.
Awesome sauce. We got an awesome show lined up tonight, as always. Looking forward to hanging out with you and other cool poets. I got to say, you know, the thing is everyone knows Allen Ginsberg for Howl. That's one of his most obviously famous poems. But, you know, I happened to notice some brainy quotes on, I think it was June 3rd, that it was his birthday. Yeah, and so, you know, I started looking at his poetry because I knew we had done Howl before, and that's quite a lot for people to take in. And it just dawned on me, you know, that the sheer amount of high-quality poetry that he has and that we ought to, like, do Ginsberg shows once every few months or so, because he really does have quite a bit to offer up as far as food for thought.
Yeah, some oddities in language in regards to what he writ.
Exactly. And when you have that kind of oddity in language, you give people the opportunity to play with their language, to experiment, and to really just think outside of the box. So, like I said, I'm looking forward to tonight's show, and I've already got a couple of guests to bring on. So, first of all, I'd like to welcome Kel. Welcome, Kel. Glad you could join us.
Hello.
Hello, Kel.
Hello, Rex.
Good to have you here. And then we have Jeremy Effie, who's somewhat, I believe, new to both Late Night Poets and to calling into our show. So welcome, Jeremy. Glad you could join us.
Hey guys. Happy to be here. Yeah, I'm a newer member, and I'm happy to be in the swing.
Hey.
Awesome.
Welcome. We enjoy newbies on the shows.
That's right. All right. So, whenever you're ready, Rex, we'll go ahead and get things rolling.
Let's kick it off.
All right. Buckle your seatbelts, people. Grab your cup of tea, your beer, your coffee, whatever it is that you're drinking, because the first poem up is going to be the intro poem, which will be the prompt poem, and we have a recording for that. So, here we go. If I can find it, I know it's here somewhere. Okay, here we go.
There's a poem called the Sunflower Sutra. The sutra, as you may or may not know, is a form of Buddhist discourse like the Platonic dialogues. Is that right? I walked on the banks of the Tin Can Banana Dock and sat down under the huge shade of the Southern Pacific locomotive to look at the sunset over the Box House Hills and cry. Jack Kerouac sat beside me on a busted, rusty iron pole, companion. We thought the same thoughts of the soul, bleak and blue and sad-eyed, surrounded by the gnarled steel roots of the tree of machinery. The oily water in the river mirrored the red sky. Sun sank on top of fine old Frisco peaks. No fish in that stream. No hermit in those mounts. Just ourselves, roomy-eyed and hung over like old bums on the riverbank, tired and wily. Look at the sunflower, he said. There was a dead gray shadow against the sky, big as a man, sitting dry on top of a pile of ancient sawdust. I rushed up enchanted. It was my first sunflower. Memories of Blake, my visions, Harlem. In hells of the eastern rivers, bridges clanking Joe's greasy sandwiches, dead baby carriages, black treadless tires forgotten and unretreaded, the poem of the riverbank, condoms and pots, steel knives, nothing stainless, only the dank muck and the razor-sharp artifacts passing into the past. And the gray sunflower poised against the sunset, crackly, bleak, and dusty with a smut and smog and smoke of olden locomotives in its eye. Corolla of bleary spikes pushed down and broken like a battered crown. Seeds falling out of its face, soon to be toothless mouth of sunny air. Sun rays obliterated on its hairy head like a dried wire spider web. Leaves stuck out of the arms, out of the stem. Gestures from the sawdust root, broke pieces of plaster falling out of the black twigs, a dead fly in its ear. Unholy, battered old thing you were, my sunflower, oh my soul, I loved you then. That grime was no man's grime but death and human locomotives. All that dress of dust, that veil of darkened railroad skin, that smog of cheek, that eyelid of black misery, that sooty hand or phallus or protuberance of artificial, worse than dirt, industrial, modern, all that civilization spotting your crazy golden crown, and those blear thoughts of death and dusty, loveless eyes and ends and withered roots below in a home pile of sand and sawdust, rubber dollar bills, skin of machinery, the guts and innards of the weeping, coughing car, the empty, lonely tin cans with their rusty tongues, alack, what more could I name? The smoked ashes of some cock cigar, the cunts of wheelbarrows and the milky breasts of cars, the worn-out asses out of chairs and sphincters of dynamos, all these entangled in your mummied roots, and you there, standing before me in the sunset, all your glory in your form, a perfect beauty of a sunflower, a perfect, excellent, lovely sunflower existence, a sweet natural eye to the new hip moon, woke up alive and excited, grasping in the black light, shadow golden, sunrise, sunset, monthly breeze. How many flies buzzed round you, innocent of your grime, while you curse the heavens of the railroad and your flower soul? Poor dead flower. When did you forget that you were a flower? When did you look at your skin and decide you were an impotent, dirty old locomotive? The ghost of a locomotive. The specter and shade of a once powerful, mad American locomotive. You were never no locomotive, sunflower. You were a sunflower. And you, locomotive, you are a locomotive. Forget me not. So I grabbed up the skeleton-thick sunflower and stuck it at my side like a scepter and delivered my sermon to my soul, and Jack Soul too, and anyone who'll listen. We're not our skin of grime. We're not our dread, bleak, dusty, imageless locomotive. We're all beautiful golden sunflowers inside. We're blessed by our own seed and golden, hairy, naked accomplishment bodies growing into mad, black, formal sunflowers in the sunset, spied on by our eyes under the shadow of the mad locomotive riverbank sunset Frisco hilly tin can evening sit down vision.
All right, Pam, why don't we start with you? Since you brought that on board.
Me? I'm assuming?
No, your mother.
Oh, okay. Well, let me get off the Ouija board. Okay. No, I am. Wow. Yeah, I have to say, I was really impressed with it. Well, first of all, that recording, you know, I knew it wasn't a perfect recording, but there was something about the way it stumbled in the beginning slightly, and then at the end where the one person accidentally started clapping before he was done reading, that it felt like such a human moment. It felt like a moment in history with its flaws captured, and I like that about that recording. Now, the poem itself, I love how it works, like many good poems do, on both a metaphorical level and a level of reality. You know, he brings us to that reality by that polluted river, that old train yard, that poor, pitiful flower growing amongst all that waste and deprivation, and he brings us into this metaphorical journey and along with his thoughts, and the fact that he had Jack Kerouac mentioned in the poem also was a nice nod to his own personal history and the history of the Beat poets and how they were very close connected, not only as poets but as friends, as poetry brothers. And I like how, in the end, this is all about how, you know, how too much of it's all about too much of wanting to make money of the big machine, of everything that's taken over and polluted humanity to the point where we forget what it means to be good to each other, what it means be good to ourselves, to remember that we are someone and something that's worth standing up proud and loving. You know, I just think this is a powerful, emotive write and very well done, of course.
Well, thank you, Pam. And Jeremy, how about you?
Hi, sister.
Planned on calling in tonight anyway, but the fact that you guys are talking about Ginsberg just puts me over the moon. I'm a huge, huge Ginsberg fan. Don't know how every poet doesn't just love stuff like this that he does. This is the first time I ever heard this recording, and I want to speak to what Pam said first. Yeah, there's a huge human element to it, and I would have given anything to be one of those Beat poets or just someone sitting in the crowd and just to feel the crazy energy he has when he reads his poems. There's definitely a formula to what he does that I just love because it's a train ride that you just want to throw the lasso around and let him drag you down the tracks because I just have a huge smile on my face the entire time. It starts off very analytical, very serious, and very real. And then Ginsberg just lets the wheels fall off, and I love that about him. He gets sexual. He gets political. He doesn't seem to care. It's the same with Howe. It's the same with almost everything I read of his, and it definitely shines through in this poem. Ginsberg is one of the great guys. I can't wait for the rest of the stuff, the odes that we're going to see that are in this spirit, because, like I said, I'm a huge fan.
Excellent. Thank you, Jeremy. And Kel, how about you?
Well, I have, you know, I have a hard time with all the metaphors and stuff, but I thought it was really... What caught me wasn't so much the sunflower, which is what I'm basically about, but the locomotive and how he describes those, the locomotive and all the, basically all the rubbish around it and everything, and then the beautiful flower coming up. You know, it's just... It's a very visual poem, and I can't wrap my head around all of it.
I get it. That's not a problem.
Yeah, can I add to that too, Kel? I'm sorry to, if I'm speaking out of turn.
Yeah, please.
No, you're
yeah,
fine.
Kel, I get it, Kel. I mean, there's no way. I mean, he is such an out there kind of ethereal guy with his poems that I would challenge anyone to go line for line and understand exactly what his mind is doing. And to me, when reading Ginsberg, that's the beauty of it. If you just kind of let go and let Ginsberg be Ginsberg, it really is just, it's like a stream of consciousness that's just kind of, it's like sitting with the, Alice in Wonderland, sitting at the tea party and just letting them be nuts. And it's just kind of an explosion of beautiful words.
I liked it. I liked all the visuals and everything about it. It's just, I don't always get into the deeper meaning and things.
Sure.
So, but this
sure, that's
was,
fair.
I mean, it was an absolutely beautiful poem. You know, don't get me wrong. I loved it. I loved the poem itself. It's just I can't look in too deep. My brain just doesn't let me do it.
I agree.
But yeah, it's a beautiful poem.
Hey, Rex, don't forget we also have Felon with us. So welcome, Felon.
Oh, Felon. How you doing?
You could join us.
Oh, hello, Felon.
At least I didn't have her.
Oh. Okay, and in and out. All right.
Let me check. Oh, no, she did drop. Darn it.
All right, for me, this was a mad dash through an image-stoked voice, blistering all things in celebration of that sunflower, which he then plucks for himself. It's all about death and determination and that which we make of things. Whether it be the destruction or the building, it's all a matter of perspective. All right, Pam, we're coming back your way.
All right. I like that, Rex. Well said there. Okay, so our next poem up is actually a carryover, so it's not inspired by tonight's prompt, but it is going on the third week that's a carryover because I missed it last week, so I would feel absolutely horrible if it wasn't the next poem read. I have up Tango in the Mango by Rob Azza. And Jeremy, would you be able to give that a read for us, please?
You bet. I'll give it a shot. Tango in the Mango by Rob Azza. Now, what's this piker saying on these pages? Lots, but your ginormous hand is slung too snug around my shoulder. Better? Better. Now I'm dizzy with this philosophy. Not me, of course. Not all frocked up and fancy-handed. Not so. Just immersed in his delivery, his wit, his might. I can't keep up with this drizzle. It's making me sleepy. Read slower. The power through the powder. Can I rest my head where you rest, where your hand sits? You shall not. Can I close my eyes and listen to you read? You shall not. May I? You may not. Okay. When he speaks of tigers, that tango and mango, that fall and the swallowing, swaying ways of that of the gypsy, yes. Yes, I have read those parts. Excellent. Now read them again, just slower this time. My hand aches against your bolder shoulder. Breathe and relax. His words can cradle you, but I will not. End poem.
Great read, Jeremy. Thank you very much. And Pam, has Felon come back on yet? Or is that still a no-be?
Let me go ahead and check. No, she has not. I know she said something about working, something to do with working a movie. So I don't know, maybe she's become a movie star and has no time for us. But hopefully she'll call back, and I'll keep checking occasionally.
Well, all right, go ahead and kick off a comment on this one. This was off of, this was from that that Picasso painting.
Yes, this is from the painting by poet. What's his name? Pablo. I'm sorry. I hate when I have a brain fart. Pablo Picasso, titled "Reading the Letter." I like how this has a conversational tone to it. Now, anybody who's seen this painting knows that one of the hand put over the other man's shoulder is rather large. So I like that he references that. I thought it was I had to look up the word piker, which a piker in North America is someone who places only small bets, whereas in Australia or New Zealand, it's a person who withdraws from a commitment. Now, if I remember right, Rob Azza is from Australia, but don't quote me on that. Yeah, but don't quote me on that. I for some reason that, but I could be wrong. Either way, I think it was a wonderful. I really enjoy getting to use new words and learn new words. And I really like, now I'm dizzy with this philosophy. Not me, of course, not all chalked up and fancy hand and not so just immersed in his delivery. I like how two people can be reading the same thing. And in this case, they're looking at somebody who's, you know, waxing philosophical, and one person is completely absorbed in it, and the other one just really just is not digging it. And I feel like that kind of represents poetry in itself. Again, some really nice back and forth. I like when there's also some really just kind of clever wordplay and humor in here. Okay, but when he speaks of tigers that tangle and mangle, that fall, and the swallowing, swaying ways of the gypsy, yes, yes, I've read those parts. You know, it's like you're, there's something about that imagery that, you know, that very much reminds me of Picasso's painting, but I think actually it reminds me more of the painter, who I'm also blanking on his name, who paints pictures of jungles that we featured on a Tuesday show. There's something very, with the whole mention of tigers and mangoes, it becomes almost this tribute to surrealism itself. I think it's an excellent write and very well done.
Wow, thank you very much, Pam. And Kel, how about you?
Well, I love the flow of it. I mean, it just has a really, really awesome sound. You know, like when Jeremy was reading it, it was just, he caught up in just the words. It was beautiful. I agree with Pam. I love the dialogue bit to it, you know, and the way that, you know, it works them in together, like, you know, one was really intense, and the other one was just kind of, well, you know, can I do it? Can I see it? Can I read it? Can you tell me what's going on? He says, no. And like, just leave me the hell alone. Let me read it. But, yeah, it's just, it's a very well-written poem, and it's just, I really quite enjoyed it. I can't say that there's any one bit that I like better than another. And I like the way that he mentions that the larger hand and putting it on his shoulder and everything. That was really, really well done. Beautiful.
Thank you, Kel. And Jeremy, you got to read it. What'd you think?
Great comments, guys. Yeah, I remember the show. I remember the painting. Yeah, a couple things. This is the only one that I can remember of all the comments and all the responses to the prompt. This is the only one where I can remember there being more of an adversarial relationship between the two in that painting. I could be wrong, but there seems to be a little bit more angst in this. And I like how that is kind of juxtaposed, that angst feeling between two people that are reading the same thing and then to introduce his little hints of rhyme in the poem, which you usually associate with a pairing or some kind of camaraderie. It's just kind of a duality in the poem that I really kind of picked up on. So I thought it was beautifully written, but I like the fact that there is that extra layer of turmoil, that subtext that he kind of snuck in through his writing style that kind of re-influences his point. Very cool device and a cool pickup on that image from that Picasso painting.
Absolutely. And you're right about this one was very different from everybody else's, right, when they took this picture on. This is a little more angst-driven. It starts out with a little bit of tenderness. What is it? Your ginormous hand is slung to snug round my shoulder. Better? Better. And then it gets that little tone of backbiting, so to speak. Now I'm dizzy with this philosophy. Not me. Of course not. All frocked up and fancy-handed? Not so. Just immersed in his delivery, his wit, his might. I can't keep up with this drizzle. It's making me sleepy. Read slower. Power through the powder. Can I rest my head when your hand sits? You shall not. And it continues that way, which was clever, especially when he got down to the thought of reading that part with the speaks of tigers that tango and mango that fall in the swallowing, swaying ways of the gypsy. That was a nice touch right there. And then reading it and then hitting again. Then now read them again, just slow this time. My hand dance against your bolder shoulder. So now there's the throwback on that thought. They both get into the tangle and the weave. Nicely writ, Rob. Thank you. All right, Pam.
All right. Felon, since you're back and you're having some technical problems and you don't know how long you'll be able to stick around, I've gone ahead and put your poem up. Go ahead. Give it a read for us.
Thank you, guys. If it hangs up, Pam, if you just finish it for me, okay? It's called Pussy Willow, and this is something different than I normally write, and it's called Pussy Willow, and it's a little adult thing here, so here we go. Wide-eyed from her vagina, she sprawled as the alley feline, strands bleached asymmetrical to bitch black, or maybe a frail cunt. Afterburn flares as decay swims to the stench of a fish market. Tsunami of piss takes the sidewalk, intoxicating every caught in the wave of a public, I don't give a fuck. Can't crack speaks from her shuffled pavement to ass. A contorted body language spins for more. Low to the high, finds solace in the blue sight. Breaking through the concrete sprouts a single wildflower. One parting second, she smiles and says, my daddy called me a wildflower. Then chaos choked her back to the permission to fuck for a dime or suck to get high. Either one to survive with a crack whore getting by to get high. End point.
Ow, fell. Great read.
I know, I don't
Thank
really
you very
that.
Much. Boy, that was a blitzer in there. I like that. Jeremy, why don't we start with you? What did you think?
This one's heavy. It hits hard. If we're talking in the spirit of what we learned from Ginsberg, I think you nailed it right on, because this is definitely something inspired by his voice. I can see that the parallel. I think a lot of the things that he did was for shock value, when he was just saying things for the trueness and in-your-face realness of what they are, and that's what I got out of it. You want to step back with a dropped jaw going, wow, this is a very aggressive poem. But, you know, sometimes that's what poetry needs to do. It needs to take people out of what they're used to seeing, and I appreciate your courage for putting this down on paper. I think there's a lot of...
Thank you.
There's just a lot of... a lot of realness to it. I'm kind of taken aback a bit myself, which I think is your desired reaction from someone hearing this the first time. I appreciate the poem.
I have the same thing from Ginsberg, so yes, absolutely. Thank you.
Well done. Very much enjoyed.
Thank
Good
you.
Job.
All right, Pam, step on up.
Oh, bravo, Felon. Yeah, this is awesome. You know, just the right amount of swearing to put. You don't hold back. It's raw. It's honest. It's brutal. And, you know, it's interesting that just like Ginsberg's poetry, there's often that little bit of beauty amongst all the ugliness, you know, where it says, you know, through sprouts a single wild flower, and my daddy called me his wild flower. Chaos choked her back to her mission. You know, like, it's like this, in this ugly life of this crack-addicted prostitute who just, mm-hmm. his whole life is earning money through sexual acts, selling herself, getting high, abusing her own spirit, her own body. It is this whole idea that there's this flower that exists, the flower that was her once upon a time and still has
right.
the potential to be her. This is just absolutely powerful and very well done.
Thank you, Pam. Thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
And Kel, how about you?
Oh, I totally agree with Pam. I mean, this is and Jeremy. It's a very strong piece, notwithstanding the swearing, you know, which is fine. It just gives it more of a kick. Yeah, it's just, wow, very, very deep and very strong. And I don't see how I can say anything more than what's already been said. Okay.
Thank you, Kale.
I really, really enjoyed this.
Yeah. Thank you.
Very well done.
Great. And Phil, this is stark. This is an ice-cold bitch slap to the face. And you've taken
mm-hmm.
it from the crack whore's point of view as you're rolling this out. You're explaining her in her language, so to speak, and how she lives on the street and what she does to keep that that high going. And that those last three lines just walk that with the powerful thought, especially because you offered up that single line right in the middle of it. My daddy called me his wild flower. And then she snaps back to reality of why she's on the street to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
Back to her mission, for a dime or stuck to get high. Either one is survival to a crack board, just getting by to get high. That speaks bleakly of the angle of heavy addiction, what it does to the mind, what it does to the body, what it does to the soul itself, and how you'll do anything just to get that buzz back again. It don't matter what it is.
Yeah, and people in the street don't even care. Just you know, they really don't care. I mean, I feel the work. I mean, it's sad. I mean, I've seen it over and over. And I'm sitting on a Samuel L. Jackson movie set right now, and it's a bunch of medics. We're all here and talking, and that's one thing we were talking about is how people, you know, we had all these little regular people that were homeless, and you know, we kind of laughed, but at the same time, we wanted to cry because the reality of it is they didn't even care enough about themselves to get help. Or to get out of the situation they're in. And we laugh at certain things, but in actuality, you have to laugh to keep from crying. So that's really what I gathered from Ginsberg's rights as well. So very inspiring.
Well,
great point.
That goes, I mean, a lot of what you guys do, and the same thing with cops and firemen, if they don't have that that little bit of levity which takes the edge off, you guys go fucking mad, literally.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. You have to get
exactly.
the sense of humor in something because if not, this is my 32nd year doing this, and I'll be honest, I'm really thinking about not going for the 33rd. I think I'm really done. I think that I need to find something else to get by because this is just when you get tired of seeing certain people every you know or whatever, it's like you know what, it kind of makes some really really hard decisions. So, but yeah. That's right. Was another one for me to see that too. But if I hang up, guys, it's because I'm out in the boonies somewhere. I don't know where I'm at in the boonies. Shooting a movie in the woods. I mean, like deep in the woods. So
it's always good to hear from you, Fallon.
Thank you.
Just stay close to the lights. Then you won't have to worry about the Georgia Swamp Monster.
Oh, no, they got easy go life. I mean, I'll just send y'all some pictures. You'll pay some pictures. But, yeah, I'll be listening. If I don't say anything, just know I'm on mute because we were doing something.
Okay, cool.
Okay.
All right, Pam, back your way.
All right, Kel, your poem is up. Go ahead, give it a read for us, please.
Okay. This is called Whistle Silence. An old, rusty, dusty caboose off track, relic of days gone on steel railroad, alone forgotten in timeless history. Spurs of coppery flux rusticate throughout this old and ironic beast. Weathered, whitewashed fleece, faded graffiti passerby linked the rail cars, thrust forward, derailed. Iconic off-rail engine seized by industrial downfall, lost glory. Caboose has settled in muddied fields, rust-coated iron wheels embedded in tufted sage grass, vines of clover leaf, orange-spiked tiger lilies, and stinkweed, blue and white engineer, and pinstripes. Waves of children chasing beside, now a memory of fractured glass, windows framing smiling faces. Sunflowers grow where men stood, twiggy nests, birds' eggs covering the gears of locomotive engines, steel wheels clattering on ironclad tracks, and the distant whistle is silenced by time. Remembered by old-timers who worked the rails, crossing over the tracks in flannel shirts and coveralls, reminisced over coffee and cigarette smoke inside diners with flirty waitresses and friends, and a poem.
Great read, Kel. Thank you very much. All right, Pam, what you think?
I have to say, I am a really big fan of this poem. First of all, the shape that you chose to put it in, like the smokestack of an old engine, I thought was very cool. I'm just, I really like poems and stories that involve railroads and trains. They're such an important part of history. Like here in this town, our school is the Spooner Rails. We have a railroad museum because we were, this town was basically built because of the railway system. And it was a huge part of the economy of the town throughout many decades. Not so much anymore, but it's an important part of the history of not only this town, but this part of the Midwest as well. And I really like how you make us look at this old, rusty train, that just in itself doesn't look very pretty, but you remind us of everything that grows around it. You remind us that this train once had a past, and it's a past that people, the old-timers, remember. They remember because the railways didn't happen on their own. The trains, the stations, the economy was all driven by the hard-working, everyday men and women. Interestingly enough, I was watching a video the other day. They actually used to purposely stage train crashes and sell tickets to them. Like, that used to be a type of amusement. I found that fascinating. Side note there, nothing to do with the poem.
Wow.
Side note. Yeah. But I really like now a memory of fractured glass, windows framing smiling faces, sunflowers grow where men stood, twiggy nest, bird eggs covering. So much. The fact that this locomotive has become a home for birds, I mean, I think that, you say you don't do metaphors well, and I get that you're like more of a straightforward thinker, and that's one of those things I really appreciate about you, Kel. But sometimes I think you come up with these things these images that work well as metaphors, because the idea of something that is technically dead becoming something that cradles life, I think in itself makes a beautiful metaphor. Excellent write and very well done.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sam.
Thank you very much.
And Jeremy, how about you? What do you think?
Yeah, I'm glad you picked up on that, Pam, because what Kel did here in the formatting, something that I often fall victim to is trying to create my justifications to make the overall look of a poem correct. What you created here in this layout and this justification, Kel, is it reads terrain, and it's not easy to do. It's not easy to do and still have the poem flow as masterfully as what you've created does. If I didn't read a word and I looked at this, I would think train. And I think that is a talent in itself in setting this thing up and making the words fit and making it all make sense, that is a talent and a craft in poetry that is underutilized, and I think you did a very good job of that. One thing that I noticed in this is that you didn't put any line-ending punctuation. And when you were reading it, I noticed how it just kind of – it continued from line to line, and it flowed. You did have some internal pauses with commas, but the way it flowed from line to line, it just gave me that driving sense of a train going down the tracks. I mean, I don't know if it was conscious or not, but it was a – it was a continued – it was like a long, continued – driving thought that I thought very much supported your overall theme on the poem of train. And I appreciated how you made the ode of taking the symbolism or the themes of train and also sunflower and coping this as akin to what the inspiration of what Guinea did in his poem. So excellent job. Wonderful work. I was very impressed with what you did here.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Great comment there, Jeremy. Thank you. I too was struck with the fact that, looking at this, it's a full frontal view of an old train, and you recognize that thought, especially when you come down to the bottom and you've got that one top line, which is a nice extended thought for the railing that actually went around the old locomotives themselves, so you could have that walk around to the what they used to call the cow catcher, and you even laid that out in the bottom four lines as well. So that was a nice touch. Now, everything you got in here had me walking on that line of that picture itself and those leftover views that people see of sightings, unused sightings where these old wrecks lay. And it brings you back to that time when people used to pick these up cheap and they'd run them off as ice cream shops, little diners mm-hmm. in town, and little a tiny something or other of a business, because that's all good steel there. It's not being used. It's just rusting away. So the thought is, you know, just letting have like the out in Arizona, the plain graveyard, all these planes out in the middle of nowhere just rotting away, and that material can be used for other things, just like this can be used. You can turn these into small homes as well, for that matter.
Yeah.
It just paints that sort of there are more uses for these things than letting them rot where they in situ, as opposed to actually finding a home for them somewhere to be used properly for something or other. You're very well.
What is playing? The layout wasn't intentional. I didn't even notice until I was actually done with it. And oh my God, that actually looked like a train.
Oh, that is so cool.
But it wasn't intentional when I wrote it. Huh? What? Hello?
Well, accident as it was, it worked out perfectly.
Yeah, it did. So, yeah, I'm really proud of this one. So, thank you, guys.
Oh, you're very welcome. All right, Pam, where you want to go next?
All right. Up next is Sweet Caroline Sunflower by Eric Fenton, and we have a recording for that one. So here we go.
Sweet Caroline Sunflower, bonded knee bends in magi adoration. Sweet Caroline Sunflower, morning sun, smiley face, plucks me head over heels back in time. Forever in blue jeans, on the tube train of singing, metal wheels spark a lark, metal carriages curve through Snake Mountain Pass. Blue jeans rule while Neil Diamond serenades freedom. Gainsborough pastoral painting life left behind. 19 years old, obeyance to bugle call. Serve thy country, young gun. Protect its borders from communism. Defeat the Red Bear at all costs. That's how Ginsburg entered my life. Parade ground hell hole. Murders operandi. We break you down. Reduction deconstruction. To vermin life was winter desert hard. Military concrete mixer reality cemented all walks of life. Caught with contraband material could lead to court-martial. Are you a communist? Apartheid bubble existence showed signs of strain. Ginsburg understood the language of hillbilly troops. July intake desert training camp froze more than balls. Ginsburg pastoral farmland shocked by reality. Duality dance a Toro tango with licorice all sorts. Sweet Caroline Sunflower, bonded knee this morning bend happily. Scarab slow 2 years military service passed. Dung balls gathered between corporals cuss and curse. Ginsburg shone beneath torch-lit bunker reeds at night. Feet blistered by boots, Ginsburg inspired. So when the parachute battalion visited Hell's Kitchen base camp, Poe took the plunge. Skipping rope exercise totally screwed up. But by hook or by crook, sexy, sassy lieutenant with blowtorch blue eyes called my name. Evacuation to South Africa's elite parachute battalion. No sunflowers there. Just the angst-ridden cry of caged fish eagle mascot. Oh, and Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass to join Ginsburg. Many a sweet flag, Spartans jostling shower sprays, mercenary contraband material, safely stashed under Dixie pan ironed perfect bed. Metaphorical, categorical, correct, Sergeant. Blowtorch eyes looked the other way. End poem.
Great read, Eric. Thank you very much for the SoundCloud. It's greatly appreciated. That was wonderful. And Jeremy, why don't we start with you? What'd you think?
Yeah, and Eric really knows how to read a poem. That was wonderful. That was wonderful to just sit back and experience. Wow. A couple notes that I had on it. I like one thing that Pam said in the opening when we heard Ginsburg original is how he mentioned Jack Kerouac in his poems. And I noticed across his body of work, Ginsburg was a huge name dropper. And I like how this poem continually called out Ginsburg himself in it. I thought that was very Ginsburg-esque to make those nods. And I even caught myself thinking Ginsburg every time he said Gainsborough. So it was like a constant nod of that name dropping that is kind of a hallmark, I think, in Ginsburg work. There is one line that just blew. There it is. In the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5th. The last line in the 5th. Duality dance, a torrid tango with licorice all sorts. that gave me a chuckle. I love the sound of that. I love the I just love the way it took my head. I thought this was a wonderful poem. I think Eric did a great job keeping the spirit of the prompt. And even in the very last, when he starts the last stanza off with "oh," that almost seemed like a Howl reference to me, because there's that's what he does in Howl all throughout. So I thought that Eric nailed it in terms of getting the Ginsburg style down. And I love hearing his voice. I love the way he purposely pronounces every single word of his poetry. He does a wonderful job, and it's a wonderful performance.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Jeremy. All right, Pam, how about you?
Oh, I really enjoyed and appreciated this, right? You know, it always amazes me when you can take one prompt and get so many different takes on it. And I have to agree with Jeremy that he definitely captured that spirit. I like how he oftentimes has so many historical and cultural references. And you know, to me, the general theme I get from this is a kind of awakening, both a sexual awakening and an emotional and intellectual awakening. A young man who lives in a culture that's all about joining the military, you know, following orders, making sure you're not a communist, and then he discovers Ginsburg, and he discovers Neil Diamond, and he discovers Walt Whitman, and he discovers the beauty of the grass and the flowers. And I thought it was also a great nod to Ginsburg, you know, having that line in there, you know, protect its border from communism, defeat the Red Bear at all costs. You know, because I don't know if Ginsburg actually was a communist or if he just was accused of it. You know, goodness knows I've been accused of being a communist just because I don't like Skittles. But, you know, so it could easily be. But, you know, I feel like he takes us back to that Cold War of the 1980s. And he takes us back to a time period where there was expectations upon people for how they would serve their country and how they would think. And there's such a sense of personal blossoming and learning and growing and realizing that there's more to the world. And yes, I have to also agree that there's just some wonderful nods and references to Ginsburg throughout this whole thing. And it's an excellent write and very well done.
Thank you very much, Pam. And Kel, how about you?
Oh, I loved it. I like Eric. I mean, the way his speech is just amazing. And he's so easy to follow. Although, you know, he gets really deep. And this is a very powerful, deep piece. You know, and I get the same sense that Sam did. It's like a coming of age. And this young man, you know, lives in this, possibly a community that's, you know, basically small, and, you know, he's got these things he's got to live up to. And it's just really, really an awesome way of putting that in there. And I like the references he made to Ginsburg, too. It is, you know, made it seem more real. There was something else. Oh, yeah. And I like the line, duality dance, the torrid tango with licorice all sorts. That made me laugh because licorice all sorts is a candy in Australia. It's like a hard pack. So any reference to Australia kind of gets me going. But I really enjoyed this poem. Very well done.
Well, great comments, everybody. I was struck by the thought of truth that lines this piece. You look at that opening stanza: bonded knee bends in magi, adore adoration, sweet Caroline sunflower, morning sun smiley face, plucks me head over hills back in time. That's a nice notation to looking back through the years of life's experiences, and then the thought, the youth hitting that train to take his 2 years of mandatory duty in the military. And I love the thought using Gainsborough twice to outline that Gainsborough's pastoral painting life left behind. Now that gives you an idea. You look at Gainsborough paintings, that pastoral life is kind of hilly. It's lush, it's gorgeous, it's rich. So it gives that that vision of what a lot of people want, but very few get. And he's coming out of that and being introduced to a life which is at odds with that, because you go from that pastoral beauty into concrete and desert as training. Then he hits on, that's how Ginsberg entered my life. Parade ground hellhole. Modus operandi, we break you down. Reduction, deconstruction, the vermin life was winter desert hard. Military concrete mix of reality cemented all walks of life. There's truth in that. They break you down so you become a singularity. You work, you focus, congeal yourself as a single entity. So if you are forced onto the battlefield, you don't split, run, hide, or cower. You all work with the same goal in mind. That's keeping the next guy to your left and the next guy to your right alive, because they're your bodyguards and you're their bodyguards when it comes to the heat of battle. And the thought of the contraband material, are you a communist? He got caught with the book. So, and the thought right there is pretty cool, especially hitting on that thought. Apartheid bubble existence showed signs of strain. So my guess is this is probably early 70s, especially with the thought to Neil Diamond and Sweet Caroline. And I, too, was struck right after that Gainsborough pastoral farm, that shocked by reality. Duality dance, the tarred tango with licorice all sorts. Boy, does that say a whole lot in one single line. And if you're not careful, you miss it for the ease that it comes across. And then again, Ginsberg again. And it is as much as a name drop as it is a truth to reality. They didn't have much to read, and this and one of his books was a hell of a thing to have to read and enjoy, because pretty crappy. And most of the reading material is, hey, manuals. Read your manuals and how to clean your weapons. Read your manuals on this, proper uniform etiquette and everything else. So having something different is a blessing. And I love that thought. He finishes out again. Blue blowtorch eyes look the other way. There's a nice touch going back to the book itself, as well as that that torrid tango. Wonderful read and write there, Eric. Thank you very much. All right, Pam.
That was some wonderful observations you made there, Rex. I really like how you touched upon how the losing of one's individuality and the judgment that comes from being caught with such reading material. So, very cool. And up next, we have Yesterday by Gerald E. Green, and we have a recording for that one. So I'm going to go ahead, find it, and push play.
Yesterday, written in red by Gerald Green. I stopped to rest before heading up the hill, letting other bikers whiz by with no wave or word, as strong legs raised sweaty rumps off narrow seats to muscle shiny pedals into a new rhythm of ascent. An old wooden bench offered comfort, and the river before me invited attention. and a view to stimulate what lay dormant following death, wake, funeral, and their companion, depression, on a cloudy day. To my right on the river's muddy bank sat a man with a pole in both hands, waiting for fortune to strike, reminding me fishing is a poor man's casino. Some men sit for hours with nothing to say, no burdens to lend to sympathetic ears, no desires to raise a heartbeat, no dreams of success on any scale, just another day of perverted destiny. Across the river lies an abandoned Plymouth that was once sky blue, but now speckled with rust. I wonder how many hours it took to design the piece of faded chrome attached to the rear fender. And I wonder about the joy of anticipation some new salesman felt when he opened the door for a customer with a pre-approved bank loan, the kind of happiness that demands celebration. How many days did it take to create the molds for those worn-out tires? Where are the dreams of Mr. Plymouth now that all he did is gone? The cold, hard bench seems a bit harder as I consider the scene of futility, where only fish seem to fit into the world with balance and dignity. I finally rise and return to my bike and head back, leaving the hill for another visit, on a day when the sun is shining and fish are biting, a day when life has more appeal. End poem.
Great read, Gerald, and thank you very much for the SoundCloud. It's greatly appreciated. And Pam, why don't you kick it off?
Oh, I really like this one. It has an almost melancholy and nostalgic feel to it. It's got very raw language. It takes us to a person who really wants to appreciate life. But it's just having so much trouble because there's beauty surrounding them, but at the same time, there's ugliness. No dreams of success on any scale, just another day of perverted destiny. That is a powerful line right there. I also like what he mentions, the abandoned Plymouth. Now, when I was a kid, one of our family cars was a Plymouth, a big, huge, square thing, ugly green color. We called it Speed Buggy. And my father would take it racing all over the place because that was back when you didn't buckle your kids up and you just, you know, raced all over the place with them in the back seat. And I don't know. It just, there's something, and I think it's that part right there that's particularly nostalgic to me, but at the same time very sad because that stanza right there doesn't just represent a single car that's broken down, but rather dreams and work. And people who had jobs and lost them. I also like where he refers to fishing as the poor man's gambling, or the poor man's fishing is a poor man's casino. And, you know, that is often true, although I will tell you that with some of the expensive fishing equipment they have nowadays, you know, it's becoming just as much of a spoiled man's game, too. But I think they have a better advantage, unfortunately, although I don't think they really truly have an appreciation for what fishing means as a sport. And I thought a wonderful reading. I like that he takes us through the whole step, the whole process of him looking at the world around him, deciding how much of it he can handle, and then going back home because this is not a day, this is not a part of life that he wants to face in this moment. And I think this is a beautifully written and very well done.
Nice stuff, Pam. Thank you. And Jeremy, how about you?
Very much appreciated the read. Yeah, I picked up on a couple other things while Pam was commenting, so I appreciated hearing her thoughts on it. Originally, I thought this was... It had that melancholy feel, obviously, in the second and in the closing line, and that was it. But as I paid more attention to what Pam was picking up, I realized that he's kind of equating this through metaphor on decay and the breaking down of everything as he goes into detail with the Plymouth. there's an appreciation for that decay, though. The fact that there's so much attention paid and thought paid to the detail, how things were made in the Plymouth, how things are sitting, there's kind of an acceptance. I'll lay my cards down and accept what life has given me. So even though there might be that melancholy feel, it's not an angered melancholy. It's kind of a surrendered melancholy, which in that, if you think about the whole cycle of life, there's beauty in it. And that's what I picked up on the most, was how beauty was found in the details of this. So very complicated poem that even if I spent some more time with it, I'd probably pick up more of what he was intending to do. But I very much appreciate the effort and very much appreciated the read.
Well said. Thank you. Thank you there, Jeremy. That picture is Eric's pastoral scene. It might not be a Gainsborough, but is that pastoral beauty that Eric was talking about in his piece. Now, starts out with, "I stopped to rest before heading up the hill." There is a note of hope in that opening stanza. Then he gets into old wooden bench. And then it gets into melancholy, but I'd say it goes a little further. Depression kind of hits in there too, because he offers up following death, wake, funeral, and their companion, depression on a cloudy day. So there's a heavy notation in his voice. And then he notices the man with a pole in both hands offering up fishing is a poor man's casino. He's already equating someone else's joy in the moment as something not worthy. Yeah, he might have done that at a past time. At this point in time, there's no reflection to it because he's sad, he's hurting, and he's not really ready to meet the challenges of life past the partner he just buried. I like that thought, "Just another day of preferred destiny." And the thoughts with the car were a grand old thing. It goes back to an age when America was built with American things that were sold across the world, and they stood the test of time, where now they don't. It's apparently we build things now to break, because he hits that note with, where is it? "Where are the dreams of Mr. Plymouth now that all he did is gone?" Because Plymouth no longer exists, except for those cars you can pick up, the older muscle cars now that people cherish, that are worth a fortune. There's a celebration in that note of that life gone, just like that pastoral picture he's offered up as a thought to where he is. He equates that type of life, which is no longer possible. And then he keeps hitting it. "The cold, hard bench seems a bit harder. I consider the scene of futility, where only fish seem to fit into the world with balance and dignity." That kind of hits on the thought, maybe he's lost his job on top of that, and at his age, he can't find something else. And then the ending stanza kind of hits on that thought of maybe after doing this a few more times, he might find that little bit of hope left in to actually view this as life worth getting into, and maybe joining the old man for fishing, even if it's got nothing to do except sit down or talk with him, maybe share a couple of beers. All right, Pam, coming back your way.
Great comment there, Rex. I like that you saw the hope within there. Up next is Karmic Sutures by Maria Dark. And Rex, will you give that a read for us, please?
Karmic Sutures by Myriad Dark. I had visions of walking under the alabaster skies of some downtown anywhere and sitting under the shadows thrown by the Great Southern Cross at midnight, a deserted rail yard and long, empty, petrified forest town. I might have been reading Kerouac or his trickster, dual drinking opponent, Hank Bukowski, each overshadowed by too much alcohol and empty, spent women. I don't recall the misery, but I do remember the black dog thoughts wrapped around us like the gnarled gears of rusted out machinery. I also remember the dry sticks riverbeds we crossed over, stagnant pools of water like brief apocryphal encounters, and long roads to nowhere stretched before us, and charcoal-smudged horizons delineating marginal land and sky. It was as if God the Surgeon had taken this world and transfused and sutured its lifeblood like the massing grayness around the edges of a typo death notice. I used to read them voraciously, these hymnal litanies, if only for the joy of realizing I was not among them, visionary epitaphs, sonic and spherical. Equally prescient were the holographic projections of past indiscretions, pitiful moments of self-reflective isolation, listening to dead music and contemplating my own demise. Again, purely self-serving and pointless. I was chasing cobwebs and shadows without conscience or purpose. I read of the likes of Blake and Vonnegut, if only in snippets and coarse trepidation that someone would actually ask me about them or their writings. I was suturing up my own shortcomings and a plethora of karmic responses and fear of future endeavors, a head full of scant deliveries like Ginsberg's howl. I was a victim of my own crimes and lamentations. There were too many icons and reliquaries dedicated to our mummified heroes, pharaonic musicians of notoriety, godheads and dharmic practices leading us towards the uncertainty principles of doubt and faith. We were the rainbow bridge, aspects of our own invention, filibustered and full of karmic residue. Blessed are we, of flesh and viscera, of pistol and stem, of karma and faith, the thickness of shadows, where our sermons and epistles are resolute as the sunset and dark as the coming storm. End poem. Woo-hoo. Jeremy, what'd you think?
Wow. Wow was what I thought. First of all, incredible read. I mean, I hope the poet, the author, gets to hear your interpretation, because you did this beautiful justice. That was an incredible read. Damn, with this poem. I mean, it's thick, and I love every minute of it. I think I read it in sections. I think when I can see where they changed gears. Let me see if I can accentuate what I'm trying to get at. In the beginning, I feel like there's a camaraderie with what she talks about with Kerouac and Bukowski, and you feel like you're sitting along with them, and there's a kinsmanship to it. But then I think there's also other references as we go further on. We go to Blake and Vonnegut, and there's a feeling of inferiority to a degree on what they did. I was suturing up my own shortcomings and a plethora of karmic responses and the fear of the endeavors. I feel like there's a nod of comparing themselves constantly to the greats, which really isn't fair, because what I read in this is there is a lot of beauty, and it's hard to compare one work of art to another and be fair and true. Everything stands on its own legs in its own time. I was damn impressed with what they did with this poem. That last stanza, I got lost in it, and it was a beautiful place to be. Sometimes, like I tried to express at the very beginning of this show, was getting caught in the swirl of poetry when someone just lets their words and be the beauty of the moment they're creating. And along with letting Rex read this and hearing his cadence to the poem, it was a cool experience. I applaud both the author and Rex on all of this. It was cool. Enjoyed.
Nicely said, Jeremy, and thank you very much. Pam, how about you?
Yeah, well, first of all, I have to agree. That was a wonderful read that you did. I just, you know, this just, wow. It is one of those poems you say wow to. I really like how there seems to be so much of the poetry tonight seems to be about self-reflection. And when I was listening to Jeremy comment, and he brought up comparing ourselves to other poets. We do tend to do that. We compare ourselves to famous poets. We compare ourselves to each other. And in some ways, you know, being a bit competitive can be a good thing because it helps us, I think, many of us, depending on your personality, I know me, to hone your craft. On the other hand, it becomes almost an obsession where you tear your own soul apart to become that so-called perfect poet. I did like, I really got a kick out of the line. I might have been reading Kerouac or his trickster dual-drinking opponent, Hank Bukowski. The idea of almost is like of Bukowski being like the trickster, the coyote from Native American tales, or the raven, the, you know, the trickster animal or god, like Loki, I thought was very funny. To me it was. And then I really liked the reference. It was as if God, the surgeon, had taken this world and transfused and sutured in its lifeblood. And the thing I noticed about this poem that's very Ginsberg-esque, to steal the word that Jeremy used at the beginning of the show, is that he has myriad dark, like Ginsberg, has what you would almost call run-on sentences, where you start to think, is that worthy needed? And then you stop yourself from thinking because you really just want to enjoy the way somehow this poet has had the brilliance to make a sentence work that really shouldn't. And if you overanalyze it, you're just going to lose that appreciation. I like the use of the word pharaonic, musicians of notoriety, godheads, and dharmic practices, leading us towards the uncertainty principles of doubt and faith. The whole idea that there's so much of life that bombards us till we forget what it is that we are supposed to mean to each other and to life and to existence. I think this is a wonderful thought-provoking write all the way through and very well done.
Well said, Dan. Thank you very much. I hit on that that opening stanza. I really enjoyed it. It hits a nice tone from the way it starts, but on a different level, sitting under the shadows thrown by the Great Southern Cross at midnight, a deserted rail yard in a long, empty, petrified forest town. It runs off the same thought with the train itself on that all alone on rusting away, but he does it in a different fashion, offering up something a little more idyllic. And then the thought of Kerouac and Bukowski. Now, he hits on a number of thoughts within there. I think though, when mentioning those characters, he's also hitting on that style of language and thought that walk with him. Too much alcohol, empty spent women, the misery, black dog thoughts, the dry sticks, riverbeds we crossed over stagnant pools of water like brief apocryphal encounters, and long roads to nowhere stretch before us. There's that nice note to a Kerouac on the road. And what else we got here? And there, I used to read them voraciously, these hymnal litanies, if only for the joy of realizing I was not among them. Visionary epitaphs, chthonic and spherical. I set that right in the middle of this piece. And I think that was deliberate because he offers up a voice to all three starting out this piece and to finish. He drops in Blake and Vonnegut, and only because he thought he might get questioned on him. He actually probably thinks they're a bit highbrow. Blake, definitely. Vonnegut, some people can either love him or take or leave him. It doesn't really matter. But then he rolls into I was suturing up my own shortcomings and a plethora of karmic responses and fear of future endeavors. Well, that comes with understanding the note of course between you and them. And hell, you're still running on that thought. A head full of scant soliloquies like Ginsberg Howell. I was a victim of my own crimes and lamentations. Now he's digging into Howell, the crimes and lamentations, the ode that Ginsberg put in Howell, and all those little tidbits and nuances that Ginsberg outlined in Howell that they got into, from the heroin to the doing it in the streets to getting into all kinds of trouble and wild, hairy games, so to speak. Now, Now, the last two, I kind of thought that was a nice touch going back to Ginsberg again. There were too many icons and reliquaries dedicated to our mummified heroes, pharaonic musicians with notoriety, godhead, dharmic practice leading us towards the uncertainty principles of doubt and faith. Now, that's coming forward to today, the fact that we've lost so much because we're putting too much into the hero worship of athletes, musicians, those big money dollar ministers on TV. And there is doubt and there's a loss of faith in that action because they aren't one to be believed because the amount of money they crater for themselves. And then he offers the last three lines. Blessed are we of flesh and viscera, of pistol and stem, of karma and faith, the thickness of shadows, where our sermons and epistles are resolute as the sunset and dark as the coming storm. That is a recognition in both ends to the light and the dark, knowing where the fallow ground is and know where one can stand wholly against what tide may come either way. Great piece. All right, Pam.
Before we move, can I move on,
you know, when you mentioned the hero worshiping, I felt like there was something in my brain that went, "Aha! That was it. That was the thought I was missing." So I'm so glad you filled in that space for me. And up next is Sunflower.
Before we move on, can I ask you both a question?
Go ahead.
Do you have any thoughts about the title of this poem? And the play on karmic sutures and maybe the reference to Karma Sutra or anything like that? I expected it when we started to have more of a sexual undertone, and I never saw it. Did you guys have any alignment with that?
Well, I thought karmic... it was sutures like, you know, that your soul cuts with.
Sure.
Yeah, I didn't think Kama Sutra, although I like that you went in that direction, but I could see how that would totally throw you off if you were like thought that direction, and then the poem wasn't quite as sexual. But you know what? Let's actually get Rex's thoughts, because his are all oftentimes much better than mine.
Well, I went with the there was a touch to it, the sexual angle, but not really heavily played, except when he hit on that thought down below of Crimes and Lamentations in reference to Ginsberg's
right.
Howl. But the karmic end, I took that purely as karma, that visceral thing where karma comes right back around to bite you in the ass if you're not careful with how you deal with karma to begin with. That whether that
sure.
be spiritual, whether that be personal.
Yeah, I was just interested. I was interested because there was such an alignment with that in the title, and then there was like a conscious avoidance of it. I mean, that was the first thing I thought of when I saw it, and it was never really addressed. I mean, obviously, I understand karmic sutures and what he was going for, but it was an interesting choice. And then also, what you were saying, Rex, in your comments, do you guys have any thoughts about why particularly I understand why Bukowski and obviously Kerouac were named in the beginning, but Blake and Vonnegut named specifically later in the poem, do you think that's just a personal choice because that's more autobiographical or because
Blake was actually mentioned in Blake was in the poem Sunflower Sutra.
Okay.
Yes.
And Blake would have been read by Ginsberg himself, yes. I'm not sure about Vonnegut.
Interesting
that's
choice.
A possibility. Vonnegut was a heavy thinker.
I could see Ginsberg reading Vonnegut. I mean, never knew the guy personally, but I could totally see it.
I agree.
Oh.
Yeah,
great
those
cool
are great questions.
Oh, might have to go and look up what did Ginsberg read beside himself.
Right. You might find, if you do that, you might actually find some prompts for some upcoming shows.
True.
All right.
Where are we going to go now?
Ready All right. Up next is Sunflower's Magic by Betty Page, and it goes like this. Twisted branches high, sweet golden, vivid colors kissed by warm sunlight, swaying through windstorms, trampled upon by hard rain, froze to death by ice, melted by scorching wildfires ablaze, full of smoke, choking out all life. Hates this sunflower, a mere shell of radiance, lost his confidence. Still, those roots remain. Yet another day full of rain, revives, petals shine. So shimmer again through ice, snow, fire, and hard rain. Revive broken hearts. Become determined to last through trials and torment. Let your love be magic. End poem.
Great read, Pam. Thank you very much. And I figured Betty's thoughts might go well with this. What do you think, Jeremy?
Excellent read, Pam. Excellent read. Definitely did it justice. I think I commented on this before with Betty, and I think this is kind of her style is the syllable count. It's something I can't do, and I always appreciate it. The fact that she went 5-7-5 on every single stanza, I love that. Yeah, there's a balance to it, and it created a flow and beauty very apropos of the tone that she was creating in all of this. I kind of was caught up on that through the whole read and checking it and reading it and enjoying it. As Pam read the poem. So very much enjoyed, but that's my note for right now while I kind of soaking in.
All right, thank you. And Pam, you got to read it. What about you?
Yeah, I have to agree. On a technical level, when Betty does her 5-7-5, it does create a sense of balance. She also is really wonderful with imagery. Now, with this one, a couple different things I noticed is, first of all, she didn't really go sensual with it or like she does with so often, and she does quite well. I also know she puts in a little note in her aunt, four seasons of a sunflower as well as seasons in one's life. And I thought that was really neat because to me when a poet puts something in their A.N., it means it was something they felt was important to say. Although, I do think the metaphor of that probably could have been picked up without the note, but I like that she felt it was important enough. And, you know, the thing with a prompt poem that has so much to offer up is that a person can choose to focus on one little part. Like, you know, in this whole poem, we had dirt and we had trains and we had a river and we had the sunflower. And Betty chose to focus on two things. First of all, the sunflower, and second of all, the idea of human growth and change, not necessarily physically, although that too, but emotionally and spiritually, and the idea that when you go through all these trials of life, you become a stronger person. You know, you become the type of person who realizes that love needs to be shared. I just think this is a wonderful write and very well done.
It is. Again, it's very different from her noble thoughts. There's no sensuality in this at all. And it does, she took a singular notation in that poem itself. One word out of the title and one thought out of the poem, that sunflower. And it is everything you all have said, but it's one other thing besides that. It speaks on the sunflower itself because the sunflower will turn to face the sunlight. So the thing she's offering up here is do not hide yourself. Turn towards the sun. Bask in that which can heal and help you to grow, because that is where you, most of us get our vitamin C. I think so. As a needed part of our growth and as a needed part of our health. Sun is that magic tidbit that a lot of people have missed out the past year because they were told to hide, and they did. So, and in sickness, you go out.
Yeah, well,
go out, sit in a hot day, sweat some of that garbage out.
I know here, up here in the north, especially during winter, a vitamin D deficiency is quite common. I know I've had that problem before when there's not enough sunlight. You know, the interesting thing about sunflowers is that when the sun is covered by clouds, they will actually turn towards each other in order to get what they need from each other because the sun isn't there. And I just think that is such a beautiful part of nature. And really, honestly, I think works well for how we as humans need to be turning towards each other in times of need.
There's reflective value in that, facing each other too, because they are yellow and they do embrace the sun, so they can sit and embalm a little bit of that and then turn in towards each other when they need to help relay that as a mirrored effect.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well said there. Yeah. All right. Shall we go on to the next poem?
Absolutely.
All right. Up next is Just a Walk by Time Teller. And Jeremy, will you give that a read for us, please?
You bet. Just a Walk by Time Teller. Went for a walk yesterday along an old railway line, nothing but flint and weed now, with a hedge along its side. From where I was to where I go, a sea harbor on my right, with reclaimed marshland, a Sussex village ahead. Across the harbor, a church, its spire visible above trees. Having got the village, I stopped and turned, and from there I went to the other direction, which coincidentally led to another church. On my way to my right were toads, calling among the farmer fields. To my left across the harbor village I had just visited. I read a visitor's history guide, how the smugglers would cross the harbor in small boats where the kingsmen went around on horseback, and so they were never caught. And I couldn't help but think, from church to church then? They build a wall of earth to hold back the sea and a reclaimed land for farming. The old railway ran along its top. Nature cursed this idea, and the sea broke through, and now parts of the harbor are marsh. And there can be seen hedge lines and ditches from yesteryear protruding onto the marshy land. I sat watching the sun lift the water into the air and felt the age of time whistle and chug along. It wasn't a very fast train, and some said that it could walk faster. Time never rests easy for anyone. The birds were about, clinging to shrub limbs and swayed and bent beneath their weight, and the yellow gorse whispered and sent upon the splashing sun drizzled drops of water from geese and ducks crowded into the slowly draining tidal channels. They must have struggled, smuggling for a living. When does next payday come? Did those people use the train for comfort or company excuse to spit with purpose? No train now. Communication is too fast for an old banger. Smuggling now means emailing ourselves across the harbor, texting the cargo from one caller to another. No need for tunnels. I want to shout and be angry at change and speed the train. Pace of erosion of privacy. I want to scream at politicians who have cause and only causes, and those who get wealthier by being one. I want to stamp my feet into the old bank's collapse until toads or bullfrogs shut their traps. Can I not throw a single stone into the tranquility of harbor, upset the boats, do a Viking raid from this side upon the other, or the little village I visited? Ransack their houses, pillage rural bliss, yet today a harbor day, sheltered and calm within the clutch of time that has passed back forth from the walk for centuries. Where is this youth of my anger gone? The turmoil of clear black and whites, the thorns of pickles and thistles. Why does understanding create the visual of the old tracks and their wagons of steam running slowly along the hedges, the young men arguing the day, and the old women passing the hay, and the pretty girl still glances from the red-cheeked boys firing their catapults through the windows. And of the harbor days, when small vessels came and went, delivering coal, wood, and cargoes from up coast, fishermen and boats returning with catches, and quartering couples from out on a leisurely sail, time silts the bottom, and the harbor gets drained, and the time has silted the synapses and pulses of extremities, extrating them to the reclamation of farmland and safe harbors. End poem.
Great read, Jeremy. Thank you very much. Pam, why don't we kick it with you?
All right. Yeah, I really like and appreciate this one. I know Time Teller was one of the first ones to comment on the contest, and he said, hard act to follow. And I said, you know, that's why we don't follow. We just get inspired. You know, and you know, when we offer up somebody like Ginsberg or Bukowski, we don't necessarily need you. We don't need you to be Ginsberg or Bukowski. We need you to be yourself and show how the poem inspired you. And I like that he took us in the direction of going for a walk. And as someone who is a walker, you know, and then obviously, I don't drive, so there are walks that I go on where it's just for the purpose of getting to the store. But then there are walks you go on, like for me in particular, to walk by the river, to watch the turtles basking in the sun, geese, and raising their families. You know, it's those kind of walks where you absorb and observe everything around you, the good and the bad. And I like the bits of wit in here, like when he says from church to church, and there's such a bombardment of thought. That's what I feel like, you know, this is one of Raw Honest Writes that takes you along not only on his walk but within his thoughts, where he realizes. He thinks about history, and he thinks about what used to be and what things have become, and how I like how it talks about the river fighting back and becoming this marshland that wasn't supposed to be there, or maybe it was, and you know, it just how things just happened, and then that kind of wishfulness at the end, that desire to have things back to how they were, to want to have that little bit of temper tantrum and stomp your feet and to scream at the politicians because who have causes and only causes or those that get wealthier by being one. You know, so many times a person's cause is simply their own need to be rich, to be popular. I really like, I mean, well, I have to just say that he weaves politics in here the way Ginsberg often does, and with a way that kind of makes you, grabs your attention. So I think this is an excellent write and very well done.
Great comment, Pam. Thank you very much. I mean, this was as much amusing on that walk. It starts out with just the thought of a walk, you know, starting somewhere, ending somewhere, and then turning about and going somewhere else on a walk. So it's kind of like that exploration of the arena that you're in. He does mention Sussex here and the thought of the sea harbor with reclaimed marshland, a Sussex village ahead, across the harbor, a church, a spire visible above trees. There's that nice notation of older times when the smaller villages they all had their own churches. Everybody went Sundays to church. Everything came in on boats, whatever the thought was, because you're a good way from London, you're better off getting everything shipped in port wise. And he hits on having got to the village, I stopped and turned back to my start point. And from there, I went the other direction. Coincidentally, led to another church. Again, a smaller little hamlet and another church. And the thought with the pirates and how they'd travel the canal while the king's men went around on horses, and they always beat them. So there's a nice notation. Then again, church to church, then from one church on one side to a church on the other side, and how things work. And I also like this one down here. He gets into that thought of, oh, here it is. No train now. Communication is too fast for an old banger. Smuggling now means emailing ourselves across the harbor, texting the cargo from one cellar to another. No need for tunnels. Now, there's the thought of how life has become to the point where it goes off in electrical waves, and all of a sudden you have what you want. And the thought there is, nobody's doing anything themselves anymore. I want to shout, be angry at change, the speed of the train, the pace of erosion of privacy. I want to scream at politicians who have causes and only causes, or those that get wealthier by being one. Then the thought of collapsing the banks, yelling at the toes. There's a nice rant in here of all that's progressed quickly, and it's outweighing that which beauty of everything, and especially the walk. And you go a lot of these places now, they're run down. They don't get visited. They don't get ships anymore. There's no more fishing because Europe gets to take that before we get to have any of it. Why? Because we gave away our fishing rights. I mean, there's that sort of like you said in the last one, time silks the bottom and the harbor gets drained. As time is silted the synapses and pulses of extremities, extraditing them to the reclamation of farmland and safe harbors. Eventually, everything will be gone. It'll either be washed away by the sea, reclaimed, or the sea will come and rise, claiming back that which we once dared to think to put something on in the beginning. All right, Jeremy, you got to read it. What'd you think?
Excellent analysis out of both of you. I loved your guys' thoughts on this one. Apologies to Time Tower. It's hard to come into these puppies dry and not get kind of swept away in the poem, so I apologize for stumbling over a couple of words while I was trying to perform it. But it was just that. It took me, while going through it, it took my head to that space, and it was hard to not kind of get caught in the imagery and the actual specific moment that Time Teller was trying to paint, and then still kind of concentrate on reading the next words. I really appreciated the fact that it was very site-specific and very genuine in the feel of it. And I like the title on how it kind of downplays the greatness of the observation of what was the surroundings, what was the environment, by calling it just a walk, when really there's a lot more thought and a lot more analysis in everything that they're seeing around them as they go, you know, on this journey. Very Ginsberg-esque. And Rex, one word that I love that you used that also feels very Ginsberg is you said it's a rant. And yeah, there is that. There is those driving words at times in the prompt that makes it feel like a rant. And I feel like this caught that spirit at times. A big plus for the poem. Very much enjoyed. Very much enjoyed.
Oh, absolutely. It kind of harkens to those easier times. And even though we've made this progression how we do things, the times aren't that easier than when the times were a little simpler.
Exactly. Exactly.
The rush. Great comment there, Jeremy. Thank you very much. And for the read, too. Pam, where would you like to go next?
All right. Up next is Lost Egg Blues by Ursula McCabe. And Rex, will you give that a read for us, please?
Sure. Lost Egg Blues by Ursula McCabe. Just 2 years ago, there wasn't this much garbage. Now, knee-high and strewn on street corners, piles of blankets black with soot, moldy clothes, bicycle tires, old shoes, diapers, pails of despair, broken souls, kiddie pools, old needles. I step over them gingerly to get to the other side of the freeway, where I shield my eyes to study bold, colored graffiti, stenciled with malice and pride. Concrete tells a story in block letters, outlined in black of the city's plight. All things are stinky now, the semi-farts as it drives by. Too many people on, not enough of them are kind. Some don't want to ride on trains or sleep under a roof. Too pissed off or sick to know better. Some just want to have clean water. What the hell to do but walk on? See the guts of a robin dead on sideways. Could have grown up to be a rose-breasted squire, a town crier. But no, robin tried to fly and fell hard on the old city sidewalk. Tiny bird feet tucked into a skeleton of bones, liver and beak displayed for all to see. Robin already knew he had but little chance. What a cruel world we have. But the egg that bore Robin was a small thing and held the fruit of life, an oval of hope, its color as blue as baby's eyes. End poem. Woohoo. All right, Pam, kick us off. What'd you think?
I really liked it, and I always appreciate Ursula's poetry, and I'm glad she wrote for the contest. She has such an appreciation for nature, and I like how she put the observations. You know, immediately she grabs our attention with the idea there wasn't, there didn't used to be this much garbage that you have to step over. And, you know, the graffiti stenciled with malice and pride. I like that she didn't just stop at bold-colored graffiti, but, you know, saw within it the emotion behind it. What the hell to do but walk on, see the guts of a robin dead on sideways. You know, that's such a great metaphor for life. You know, when we run across those ugly parts of life and we don't just stop in the middle of them and stay there, we have to keep walking on. I like how she capitalized no. You know, it's like I like when people emphasize certain words to add the kind of emotion to the right. The idea that this little robin just had to try to fly. It's like the people who jump out of buildings that are on fire because just maybe, the sidewalk will be gentler to them than the flame will be. But the fact that this ends with the idea that the robin's egg is the color of a baby's eyes, that is just a profound statement on how, no matter how ugly life gets, life continues on. It just ends with a beautiful message of hope and life, and that the future generations maybe will accomplish something that will save this world and save humanity. I think it's a beautiful write and very well done.
Nicely said, Pam. Thank you. And Jeremy, how about you?
Love the way you perform these poems, Rex. Good read. Well done. What really jumped out at me is, and I hope I'm not reading too much into what was intended, but there's kind of a dialogue here between the man-made and the nature, the ugliness of the man-made, and there was just something so perfect about in the third when the sound of the semi going, and she used the crude word farts in there as it drives by. That just seems so ugly perfect. I don't know how to better describe it. And then you see, so you almost become desensitized to all the man-made ugliness that is described in the first half of the poem, and then really the heartstrings are pulled upon when nature comes into the picture, when the robin makes the first appearance. And I don't know, if it was intentional or not, but I love that the only note of rhyme that really hit me was in the fourth between squire and town crier. It was like, okay, nature's here, beauty's going to come, and I was expecting the poem to make a turn here. I thought, okay, we've set the scene with something ugly. Now we're going to contrast that with something beautiful in nature. But no, that was the tragedy of the whole poem, was how then even the ugliness of all the man-made, all the produced, all the production, the formulated things that were created by man, then bring down nature as well. And that was the hard-hitting message in the poem, and that was carried to the end. And then it's brought back, and then the personification at the very end. I thought it was a very intelligent dance, a line that was hard to travel, and I thought the author did an incredible job of doing it.
Excellent. Great. Great thoughts there, Jeremy. I run along the same lines. Those two thoughts you just had with the rose-breasted choir, town crier, and then that next one, those two stanzas, they did delve into nature itself, but it walks two paths. It works well as a nature thought, but because of the brutality and the ignorance of all the human thought up top, but it also works well to those people living on the street within this mess as an extended metaphor. Could have grown up to be a rose-breasted squire, a town crier, meaning someone who could actually do something with the city, a future politician that might have a better way of doing things. And that thought with Robin already knew he had but little chance. What a cruel world we have. There's that notation of you seeing people curled up on the sidewalks, living out of tents or cardboard boxes. And that swings on that level, too. So I thought it was a nice note to duality. And that last stanza does offer up that tinge of hope that still bears itself open to truth. The only object there is its color as blue as baby's eyes. Yes, they are. But if you don't teach them anything, then nothing gets learned. And it's just a revolving door around the same track of life. And if they're born down there, they'll probably end up dying down there as one of those robins who don't get to be the rose-breasted squire. And they know they don't have but little chance. So I think that's the message. We've got to take care of those arenas so we don't end up with more like them. All right, Pam, we're back on to you.
Great comment.
All right. I really like that, Rex, the way you saw that extended metaphor. I really don't want to rush one last write, so we'll have four carryovers, Nan 529, Grant G, Rhyme Draven, and Kay Heartless for next week.
Cool.
So, yeah, go ahead and wrap up the show as you see fit. Perhaps mention a couple of upcoming shows.
Well, go ahead. Get them out now before I do the closing ends.
Okay. Well, join us later tonight, 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time for Twisted Tuesdays, where we are featuring the artwork of Spectrum DN, a fellow AP poet, and MK Rock is running that contest. Wednesday, 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time is our central night. Let's see, what else do we have? We've got a whole bunch of stuff. Yes. Well, just keep an eye out on the topic board and the contest that hosts and hostesses are running. And also, I'm running a contest for Friday break on through 12:30 a.m. Eastern U.S. time with some really excellent surrealism style artwork that I highly recommend checking out. And
great
Sunday
show,
is
Pam.
Father's Day. Sorry,
well, I'm running out. Yeah, Father's Day on Sunday. There's a contest up for that and a bunch of songs. If you can't find one there, dig one up for yourselves and attach it so we know what it is and join in the fun. Great show, Pam. I had a blast tonight. Kel and Sel, thank you for coming on board. And Jeremy, nice having you in for the entire show. Had a great time. Great comments and reads from you. Come back and see us again or some other shows to boot. So don't be a stranger around town here. We like new voices and expressions coming through. So you did a great job tonight. Thank you very much. And gang, we'll see you again next week. So arrivederci, bon appetit, and good evening.